Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Welcome to A Conversation with History. I'm Harry Kreisler of the Institute of International Studies. Our guest today is Ron Hassner, a professor of political science at UC Berkeley and the author of War on Sacred Grounds. Ron, welcome to our program.
Hi, Harry. Thank you for inviting me to be here.
What got you interested in this interface between politics and religion?
It was a torturous route. I started my PhD at Stanford University with the intention of studying nuclear weapons. Discovered, as many PhD students do, that once you study a topic at sufficient length, it inevitably becomes boring. But started thinking about why it was that I was interested in nuclear weapons in the first place. It had nothing to do with explosions. It had nothing to do with deterrence. It had to do with the underlying morality. That was what fascinated me. And so I switched topics and started studying morality in war, only to discover pretty quickly that at the roots of Western moral deliberations surrounding war were religious deliberations. And so I switched topic a second time and started studying religion and conflict and really fell in love with the topic.
Was this a hard thing as a political science PhD candidate to get your hands on? I mean, I understand the trajectory here of saying, hey, this is important, I'm interested in it, but then what do you do? Is it easy to get a handle on it?
It was difficult. This was in the late 90s. Osama had not yet contributed to my dissertation. And so the topic of religion and politics was understudied, and where it was studied with biases that you and I can talk about. The solution in the end was for me to take many classes in religious studies and then bring insights from religious studies back into political science.
And was there a program at Stanford where you could actually really get into religious studies?
Or
what is it, a separate department, or is it something that you have to find pieces in different other disciplines?
No, they did then and do today have a religious studies department, which is really a sociology of religion department. And I took enough classes there to earn a master's degree. It was on the far side of campus from the political science department, so I was both physically and intellectually shuttling back and forth between the two with tremendous differences in epistemology, ontology, methodology that were and remain very, very difficult to bridge.
Where do you think are the factors that help us understand why this split between the study of politics and the study of religion? Does it come out of modernization theory, the notion that in a secular world, as we become move down the trajectory of modernization, that religion really loses its importance?
I think that's one factor. And again, I can speak primarily for international relations, my subfield, and not for political science in general. International relations scholars held on to modernization theory for a very long time, the assumption that religion was going to become less and less significant. The 1979 revolution in Iran shook that somewhat. The publication of Samuel Huntington's Clash of Civilization shook it again. And it wasn't until September 11, 2001, that the field was really rattled. The bias, I think, was there to begin with. International relations in America is maybe a provocative thing to say, but I think it's also true. It's a truly Protestant social science. It is born out of 1648 and the Peace of Westphalia, the assumption that the modern, rational, secular state is and should be the primary unit of analysis. And so religion is seen as an aberration. And if religion is to matter, then it can't be states doing it. And so the focus shifts automatically to non-state, violent religious actors who can't be rational. They must be in some way aberrant. They must be violent or lunatic or fundamentalist or terrorists.
And is it what is the difference in understanding religious actors versus political actors? I mean, is it that 'cause your work, which we're going to talk about in a minute, is kind of the interface of these two sets of leaders. What is it we should understand about these two different kinds of leaders that will help us along the route of understanding what you're doing?
The American instinct is to separate the two. That may be a useful instinct from a constitutional point of view. And it may even make sense from an ideational point of view. There are religious ideas, there are political ideas, and some actors are driven more by these than the others. It makes no sense whatsoever from a practical point of view. So as you move away from the realm of ideas into the realm of practice, and you look at what religious people actually do, what political people actually practice, you discover quickly that the basic unit of analysis, the human, is as religious as it is political. That's true for our leaders, who pray as they make political decisions. And it's true for our religious leaders, who hold political power while they lead us in prayer. And so the distinction, the attempt to cleave those two, is a futile attempt to cleave humans in half. It makes no sense. It may make sense, again, in Protestant thinking. It makes no sense in Catholic thinking, Muslim thinking, Jewish thinking, Shinto, Sikh, Hindu thinking, where political action and religious action are intertwined.
I want to understand this distinction between Protestant thinking. What is it? You traced it from, you know, the settlement of the 17th century, but what is it within Protestantism that distinguishes from these other faiths?
So Dan Philpott has done beautiful work on tracing the implications of Luther and Calvin and Zwingli's thought on international relations. If salvation comes by faith alone, through ideas rather than good works, then religion becomes relegated to the private sphere. Religion is something that happens internally as humans converse with God. Religious symbols matter less. In fact, they're frowned upon in Protestant thought. Religious rituals matter less. And so American political scientists end up with a rather distorted image of what religion is. For most people on the planet, religion involves not just internal dialogue with God. It involves symbols, music, rituals, beliefs, as well as practices, restrictions on what you eat, who you marry, who you have sex with, what clothes you wear, how often you give charity, what sort of house you can and can't live in, how you raise your children. It transgresses on all spheres of life. It infiltrates and permeates every aspect, which makes it impossible to separate religion from politics.
Does this go back to your original point about why you moved into this field, namely that in the debate on nuclear weapons, for example, the bottom line, the policymakers had no way to deal with the morality of the issues, and you suddenly had people in the streets saying, hey, this is wrong, we're going to blow up the world and so on. Is that what's at work here?
That's right, although it was a dangerous path to walk down, because had I continued on that path and studied nothing but moral constraints on war, I would have again landed in this American international relations trope, namely religion matters in international affairs because religious ideas affect political ideas. And I'd like to argue, and I argue in this book and in my current work, that that's not enough. It's not just religious ideas. It's religious themes, rituals, symbols, authority structures, religious forms of power that permeate each and every aspect of, for example, war making. So to take a common example, Islam affects warfare not just because the idea of jihad, which we've been studying for decades and centuries, affects warfare, but also because a soldier who happens to be Muslim has a different conception of time, a different respect for space, different understandings of what weapons are and aren't legitimate, different days of the week on which he would like to rest, food that he is and isn't willing to eat, opponents that he considers legitimate and illegitimate. In other words, it shapes every aspect of war from the ground up.
This is probably a good point in our discussion before we get to the book to talk about the theoretical ways of viewing religion. So you start out realizing the inadequacies of the way social scientists, political scientists, international relations specialists see religion. There's this big problem out there,
yes,
and the path through political science doesn't lead you to insight and understanding what's going on. So what? Let's walk us through how you then come to see, hey, there's another issue here, and what is the theory that I can fall back on or combine or what? So talk a little about, you pose a dichotomy between a Huntington view,
yes,
and a view of somebody like Thomas Hobbes, the famous political philosopher.
So in what I call the Hobbesian view, which has a tradition that precedes Hobbes, religion is a form of politics. Religion is subservient to politics. This is what one might call the cynical view, right? You and I know, and we'll keep it between ourselves, the Pope ain't all that religious. He's just another political leader driven by avarice, driven by a desire for power, driven by a desire to subjugate. Religion here is an illusion. It's the trappings. It's the sleight of hand that the Pope uses to get even more land, military power, financial power. That's a Hobbesian view, and I think I've just signaled why it's unconvincing. The Huntingtonian view completely separates the two. Here, religion is an external actor that we can never hope to understand because it's irrational, because it doesn't drive states. It drives non-state actors. It drives civilizations. It's always destructive. And it will fall out of the sky and cause damage to rational, reasonable political decisions. It seemed to me that both of these point of views missed out on the interesting interplay between religious ideas and political ideas, missed out on the fact that most political actors were religious actors and vice versa, and that there had to be a way of looking, for example, the topic of the book, sacred places, without having to choose between sacred places aren't sacred at all, these are just political struggles, Hobbes, and you can never hope to resolve disputes over sacred places. There are crazy people fighting over these things, Huntington. There had to be some way of unraveling this to try to see the conditions under which sacred places become significant and the conditions under which disputes can be managed.
Mm-hmm. Now, what is the combination that positions you then theoretically to address the problem of sacred places, which we'll talk about in a minute?
So it's a double move. The first, which is very difficult for me as an American-trained political scientist, is interpretivism. That is, I talk to believers, I read accounts by believers, and I try to take their assumptions and beliefs at face value. I try to understand why, in their words and in their terms, these religious beliefs have salience. So if it comes to the matter of sacred space, I try to find out for them, what is this conflict about? Why do you care about this place? What do you think happened here? What are you hoping to achieve by holding on to this piece of land? That gives me a perhaps naive, perhaps it's certainly subjective and not objective. It's an attempt to empathize with the actors I'm studying.
When you say subjective, you mean their subjectivity.
Their subjectivity,
yeah.
Yes. I'm trying to get with my nose as close to the subject of analysis as possible. In fact, I'm trying to sort of infiltrate the subject. I'm trying to see it from the inside.
Get into their
slip
head.
Get into their head or their shoes, mm-hmm, and try to come up with an account that will resonate with them. Then I slowly start moving the camera back to get a more objective and more rationalist point of view that will reveal, for example, what is happening behind the scenes. How are these places constructed, objectively speaking? How are they managed, objectively speaking? Who's pulling on the strings? The truth is the interaction between those two. That is, it can't be entirely the case that the dispute over the Temple Mount in Jerusalem is nothing but religion. It's entirely a dispute between Jehovah and Allah. Because we know there are political interests at play. We know that this dispute is embedded in the larger Arab-Israeli dispute. We know that it has a history. We know that the level of levels of violence rise and fall in response to provocations, violent acts elsewhere. So there is a political logic here. But I can't also just look at the political logic. That will give me a rationalist, cold and calculating point of view that will be completely out of whack with what people actually believe. And that was one goal in writing the book. I did not want to come up with an explanation that would strike a believer as being completely alien and unreasonable. It seems to me that if you are a social scientist, your account should make some sense, at least in part, to the humans you are studying.
Now, do cultures differ in the way religion rises to the surface? Let's talk here a little about the United States. Religion came back around issues like abortion, around busing, I believe, also because there were religious schools involved, and of course now stem cell research. So is it that the sleeping giant is being awakened, that is religion in America, or is it rather that when the state, the political actors, moves on to issues that are really important to groups of people and the politicians haven't realized that yet?
You're asking me a very hard question that is slightly outside my field of expertise. My hunch would be that I don't have to pick between those two choices. My guess is that, first of all, new political issues arise all the time. Stem cell research was not an issue that troubled religious decision makers and religious communities 100 years ago. And we will see more and more of these issues come up. Gay marriage is yet another. At the same time, there are fluctuations in religious revival, not just in America but around the world, in response to modernity, globalization, very often in response to this, what religious actors perceive as a secular encroachment, a secular threat. And those two can then, when those two meet, you get conflict, sometimes violent conflict, particularly around what I've described as indivisible issues, that is, issues where compromise is impossible.
And in the case of the Muslim world, for example, it's only Islam wasn't sleeping. It was rather our policymakers who were sleeping, and they essentially awoke to a reality after 9/11. I mean, it's just telling us something about their biases.
So what you call the Muslim world is wide and varied. Reaching essentially around the globe from Morocco to Indonesia and even further east, and in each of those countries has their own reality and their own tensions between secular communities and more religious communities, a greater and lesser interaction with the secular forces permeating from the West, greater ability to resist those. So there are differences in regime type, some more authoritarian than others. And, of course, also different Islamic assumptions, depending on whether you're dealing with Sufis or Sunnis or Shias or different kinds of Sunnis. So, again, you have to distinguish between religious groups, their different practices, beliefs, social structures, types of leadership, preferences, And then you start getting a clearer picture of the conditions under which religion emerges as a potentially violent force.
So what you're in your intellectual trajectory, it's really sort of recognizing that, hey, there's something here, basically. And you, in the book, you turn theoretically to Clifford Geertz and anthropology and the whole discussion of what I think is called thick religion.
Yes.
Explain that to us.
So thin religion has been the international relations obsession so far, an emphasis on theology as the only way in which religion feeds into politics. If you want to know what Muslims think about politics, study the Quran, which is wacky. I mean, that's just not a very smart way of thinking about anything. First, because the Quran is 14 centuries old. Second, because the Quran can be interpreted in manifold ways. Third, because there are such interpretations over the last 14th century. And we can go on and on and on. But more importantly, theology is just one of many shapes that religion assumes. And so I came up with this sort of nifty acronym, THIC, stands for theology, hierarchy, iconography, ceremony, and knowledge. These are, in the eyes of most believers, important ways in which they practice their religion. It's not just in their heads. It's not just theology as possessed by the wisest of religious experts. It's iconography, meaning the pictures I have hanging in my house, the images I have in my head. It's ceremony, the rituals I participate in, the holidays, the fasts, the feasts, how I organize my calendar, how I organize my sacred space. Hierarchy, that is, which religious leaders I follow, and that's not always clear, and I don't always go by the book when I decide which imam or rabbi or priest I go to for advice. Sometimes I just pick the guy I like best or the guy whose answers I like best. And finally, knowledge, that is the sort of non-informal, low religious beliefs, superstitions, false assumptions, misguided ideas I have in my head about my religious group's belief, and I think social scientists need to look at all five. In part, the decision to study sacred space was precisely made because I wanted to look at a case in which a set of religious beliefs and practices that I could clearly identify in a very narrow range. This wasn't jihad, this wasn't holy war, this wasn't just war theory, this was a rather narrow, if important, small range of cases in which I could very carefully trace how religious theology, hierarchy, iconography, ceremony, and knowledge fed into political decision-making and how political decision-making at the same time fed into religious practices.
Let me show our audience your book again, War on Sacred Grounds, and help us understand now what are sacred places.
So here we're now shifting the conversation from social science to the study of comparative religion. All religious movements, I don't know of an exception, have some notion of sacred space. To use fancier language, their religious landscape is not homogeneous. Some places have more oomph, more mana. Those are places at which you can communicate better with God or the gods. Those are places at which significant events in the history of your religious movement happened. Those are places where you can hope for miracles, healing, wishes might come true. Those are places where you might actually see God or some sort of divine manifestations. Of course, God or the gods are everywhere at all times, but at these places, their presence is more concentrated. And so people flock to these places in order to attain these religious goods.
And what are the characteristics of these places? I mean, you've told us what happens there, but if I were a politician,
yes,
having read your book, have a particular problem, what are the characteristics that will help me realize, hey, this is really a sacred place?
So it's a problem. That's a problematic question because they come in all shapes and sizes. You and I are not particularly familiar with, Shinto sacred space or Confucian sacred space. So we have these sort of models of sacred places being these beautiful ornament buildings. They're very large. They display the religious at its most splendiferous. They often display religious imagery, both on the outside and the inside. That's not true of sacred places elsewhere. In some religions, shaman religions, for example, nature religions, native religions in Australia, Latin America, even the United States, mountains are sacred, lakes, caves. They assume all shapes and sizes, and they come in. They can be ranked by significance. So some sacred places draw believers from all around the world. Others are local roadside shrines that are really only of importance to the peasants who live in the area. Nonetheless, I've used work by sociologists of religion, primarily Mircea Eliade, who taught at Chicago, to try to see what these places have in common. This is an exercise in comparative religion that scares people who specialize in one religion and worry about drawing generalities, but I have to do that because I'm an international relations scholar. I'm not an expert in India or the Middle East or North America. I'm an expert in no place in particular. I'm interested in the globe. So I found three characteristics that these places have in common. And if you'd like to, I can elaborate on why they have these characteristics in common. The first is they are all clearly bounded. They have very clear borders. Everybody knows where the sacred place stops and ends. That's designed primarily to prevent desecration. Second, though they are often complex, think of your favorite cathedral, many parts, different components, different building materials, they form a unified function. They cannot be taken apart. That's what I call the integrity of sacred space. If you take them apart, they cease to fulfill their function. Half a cathedral does nothing for you. Third, they are of tremendously high value to believers. There is no substitute for these places. Those three characteristics combine to produce what I call the indivisibility problem.
Mm-hmm. And because they are so sacred and so important and of such high value, they're potentially very vulnerable if you
get into right. But if the issue were merely their high value, you could find a way around that. So let's imagine that you and I are not in a dispute over sacred space, that you and I are merely in dispute over this table, which is secular space, and we need to find some way. You claim it's yours and I claim it's mine, and we need to find some way to resolve that. There aren't many options. The options are pretty straightforward. Most reasonably, we can divide the table somehow. The other option is that we introduce some notion of ambiguity. You get to own the table, I get to use it, or there's actually two tables.
Well, we split it.
So that was option one, is splitting. Option two is somehow enlarging the pie. Mm-hmm. So you get the table and I get the legs, or we'll produce a second table and we'll introduce some disagreement about which was the original, and so each of us gets to go home with the table. And the third option is I pay you for the table, right? Because sacred space has these very clear boundaries, because it cannot be taken apart without losing its functionality, and because it is of irreplaceable value, those three options do not exist, which means any disagreement about sacred space becomes a clash. It becomes a disagreement that can't be resolved by means of negotiation or arbitration or compromise. It becomes an all-or-nothing fight.
And I want to go back to something as a scholar now. So you're zeroing in on this subset because you think as you said, there are few cases, but it allows you to come to a new understanding of the relationship between religion and politics.
That's right, because the assumptions I've just given you are not rationalist at all. Mm-hmm. A rational political science reading this would say, what do you mean no substitute acceptable? Let's take an example. Church of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem, alleged to be, believed to be, the site of the crucifixion and resurrection by many Christians. Indivisible because there's no financial substitute or otherwise for the actual place in which the crucifixion and the resurrection happened. How do I know this? I ask Christians, and this is what they tell me. A rationalist would say, nonsense. What do you mean, crucifixion and resurrection? That's a myth. It never happened. You know, this is just land. Give them more money. They're asking for more money. That's why I can't start with a rationalist assumption. I have to start with what the believers tell me, and I have to assume for at least part of the analysis that there is some validity to it. I don't have to choose between, are religious people always honest, or are they always conniving? They can be both. I think that would be very human of them. I think they can believe that this is actually the site of the crucifixion and resurrection, and nonetheless act strategically to control it, to derive pilgrim income from it, to advertise it to draw more believers. They can be both cynical and authentic at the same time.
It's interesting, as a scholar, what I'm hearing you say is that at some point in the process, you, as a researcher of this complex area, have to show great empathy. Yes. For the subject, although not get so caught up that you become religious necessarily yourself. And it strikes me that one of the problems with what you call Protestant social science is that it's manipulative, you know, in a way that you have to not be to actually see what's going on. Is that fair?
Yes, and our social science teaches us the importance of subject-object distinction. That is, you, the social scientist, have to stay on one side of this divide, and the thing you're studying has to stay on the other side of this divide. I think at some point in the process, that is important. I can't allow myself to be brainwashed by the believers. I can't just start and end with the assumption that this place is important because this is where the resurrection happened, because I know that's not the whole truth. There's more going on here. There are political struggles involved as well. So the solution has to be a movement in and a movement out. You start by identifying, trying to understand as best you can why people at least claim what they claim. And then you slowly draw the lens back and try to see how political interest, rational calculations drive the same processes. And there's no contradiction between the two. I think that's the important part.
You help us understand then why you've explained to us why these places are very important for particular groups of people embedded in cultures and religions and in different states. Now help us understand what leads – you enumerate a number of factors that leads – to fights, basically, to conflict.
Yes.
Over the – talk a little about that.
So we wouldn't care at all that sacred places are indivisible were it not for the case that often more than one party is interested in them. So as I say in the book, babies are also indivisible. But that doesn't matter unless the parents are about to get a divorce, and then you have issues. It so happens, not entirely coincidentally, that many sacred places around the world are the subject of dispute. The more important they are, the more likely they are to be subject of dispute. And in fact, I cannot think of a single very important sacred place around the world that isn't also at the center of some form of conflict. And that happens for a variety of processes. The most obvious is religious groups split. And as religious groups split, each of the descendants of the original group stakes claim to the original sacred space as a way of proving its provenance. This is why different Christian groups are fighting over the site of the crucifixion and resurrection. There are no Muslims involved in this dispute. There are no Jews involved in this dispute. These are Christians fighting, physically fighting. There is bloodshed inside the Church of the Holy Sepulchre because each of these Christian groups claims that it is true Christianity. So that's process one, and you see it across religious movements, including, for example, members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, Mormons in the United States, who have split into churches and are fighting, again, physically, arson, stabbings, over Mormon sacred space in Missouri, of all places. That's process one. Process two is different religious groups clashing, usually because a conquest has occurred, and that conquest is accompanied by a dominant religion. So you think of the spread of Christianity across the world. That brings Christianity into conflict with other, with local groups, with native religions. The spread of Islam around the world brings Islam into conflict with native religions. As a conqueror comes in with his religion in his backpack, and he seeks to impose his religion on the local population for entirely rational reasons, he faces this problem of existing sacred places. They can't be destroyed. They can't be wiped off the map. You can wipe the structures off, but the space remains sacred. So the reasonable thing to do is to incorporate those sacred places into your own religious tradition, the way Christians did with winter solstice ceremonies, by weaving them into Christmas. So if the Christmas tree was a threat to Christianity, the Christmas tree was brought into the home and it became the centerpiece of the holiday celebrating the birth of Christ, even though there's no sort of logical connection. And so similarly, Muslim rulers in India didn't just destroy Hindu sacred places, they placed their mosques on top of them, or they converted Hindu sacred places into mosques, and that process is then reversed. Christians take native sites, for example, in Latin American pre-Columbian native sites, and place their churches and cathedrals on top of them, and then make up or create or stretch a story to explain why this site was always important to Christians and why the native religion is really just a manifestation. That now creates a sacred site at which two religions, or sometimes, as in the case of Jerusalem, 15, 16, 17 religions are piled on top of one another in one and the same sacred space. It's like a layer cake. And if those native religions are still around, that creates conflict. In Jerusalem, this would be conflict between Jews. Assyrians are gone. The Babylonians are gone. The Romans, who use the same sacred sites, are gone. The Muslims are there. And so you have Muslims and Jews vying over the same sacred site, although they have interest in different layers. But those layers are on top of one another. So that's a second example, and there are many other. There are many others.
And in addition, you give three other reasons. Fight over real estate.
That's right.
Fight over what is a social symbol.
That's right. So a fight over real estate would occur if you have a secular group fighting a religious group. The religious group is interested in the sacred space for liturgical, religious purpose. The secular group wants the coal mine that is underneath, or if you think about Mount Shasta, not far from where we're sitting right now, the Native Americans worship this as a sacred mountain. Californians want to ski on it. That's not going to work. Mm-hmm. So these are not two religious groups in conflict. It's a religious group and a secular group. You have sacred space as a social symbol. Iraq is a great example of this, where each group tries to target the sacred space of the other group in order to humiliate or provoke or just damage, kill members of the other group. And finally, you have these very strange cases in which two groups are fighting over something completely different, but the fight happens to take place in sacred space. I just heard in the radio on the way here about the Thai-Cambodian dispute over the temple of Preah Vihear. It's a territorial dispute. It has very little to do with religion, but they happen to be fighting next to one of the most ancient temples in that part of the world. And so now the dispute takes on religious characteristics. Now there's a third party, believers in both sides, who have a stake in the dispute, even though the dispute is not because of the sacred space.
Let's get practical now. You're an international relations person interested in policy. How does this come to the fore in important sets of negotiations. And let's start with one where the Camp David Accords, the Camp David negotiations that Clinton was conducting, which almost led to an Israeli-Palestinian settlement, and in which the policymakers on both sides were oblivious to the religious issues raised by negotiating about Jerusalem.
That's right. So the three parties that met at Camp David in 2000 came completely unprepared to discuss the religious aspects of the Jerusalem dispute. They fell into the two traps that we talked about. They fell into either the Hobbesian trap that said, people are making this sound like a religious problem. We know it's really just a real estate problem. We can fix this. All we need is a ruler and a pencil, and we'll find some way to cut this up. That is completely sidelining the authentic beliefs of religious parties to this dispute. The other trap was the Huntingtonia trap, saying, let's not touch the religious issue. It's unresolvable. There is no way we can wrap our political brains around this. So you can see how these are the two extremes, right? We don't need to wrap our political brains around this. This is just politics. Or there's no way we can wrap our political brains around this. This is inaccessible to us. As a result, they did not consult with religious leaders. They didn't even consult with religious experts, which in turn had the consequence that all three sides misrepresented the facts about Jerusalem, misrepresented what their constituents wanted in Jerusalem. Ehud Barak, the Israeli prime minister, demanded a synagogue on the Temple Mount, something which no reasonable Jew has ever wanted. Yasser Arafat, who represented the Palestinians in these negotiations, refused to acknowledge any Jewish link to the Temple Mount, something that makes absolutely no sense in mainstream Islamic thinking, which derives its interest in Jerusalem in part because of its Jewish heritage. On both sides, negotiators tried to resolve this, as the chief negotiator over Jerusalem later said, as a real estate problem, and they were baffled when it turned out to be the most important issue in the negotiations and the one issue they simply could not bargain over.
Now, you talk about two case studies. We can't go into all the details about both, but let's talk a little about them, where the political leadership was sensitive to the religious implications of what was happening. The first one is when Israel took over Jerusalem and the holy sites in the course of the 67 war. The other is the seizing of the religious sites of Mecca by Islamic extremists, and the Saudi government had to intervene. Talk a little about those two cases. You're saying in both cases that there was political sensitivity to the complexity of the religious issues that yes. were raised. What was Israel's problem?
Israel's problem was unique. The Temple Mount or Noble Sanctuary in Jerusalem, which takes about a fifth of the old city of Jerusalem, it's this big platform, and that's where Muslim sacred sites are located on top of the most important Jewish sacred space. This was not an issue throughout much of history because Muslim rulers over Jerusalem barred any Jewish access either to the city of Jerusalem and certainly to the platform itself. In 67, among other things, Israel gains control over this platform, and there is tremendous jubilation. You may remember this. I'm a little too young. As Jews, for the first time in literally 2,000 years, gain access to their most important sacred site. And Israeli leaders recognized wisely that this would create immediate conflict. I say wisely because we know that in small sacred sites in the West Bank, the Tomb of Joseph, the Tomb of Rachel, the Tomb of the Patriarchs, these are in Hebron and Bethlehem, there was immediate conflict between Jewish worshippers and Muslim worshippers. They represented different political entities. They came with different religious beliefs. More importantly, they came with different religious practices. The Jews didn't want to take their shoes off. The Muslims insisted on issuing the call of prayer in the middle of Jewish prayers. They scuttled in the prayer space. The Jews burned the Qurans. The Muslims burned the Bibles. There were stabbings and Molotov cocktails. The Temple Mount is the most important of all these places. It's the largest of all. There was no way for the Israeli government to bar Jews from entering the space, and there was certainly no way that they were going to bar Muslims from entering this place. So there was this very realistic scenario of tens of thousands of Jews and tens of thousands of Muslims trying to pray there at the same time and coming to blows. And those blows would have reverberated very quickly around the Middle East.
And so the solution, as you describe it, was that...
Oh, don't give it away. Have them buy the book.
Oh, okay. So, but...
No, we can talk about it.
Okay. That's maybe they should wait for the movie.
It's a teaser.
But in the end, they let's say it this way: there was consultation and understanding of the religious issues, and a solution was found that made religious sense.
And that solution, I argue, almost always depends on the ability of political actors to bring religious actors into the picture. So let's take a step back, if you don't mind, and talk about religious actors and their role. So from the point of view of the believer, the religious actor leads the ceremony and participates in the consecration of sacred space. A religious actor doesn't make the space sacred, but they attest to its sanctity, and they have to go through a variety of rituals and blessings and hand motions and symbolic gestures in order to make space sacred and unmake sacred space. If you think about cemeteries being moved, churches being torn down for highway construction, religious leaders do this all the time. Religious leaders are constantly implicated in the making and remaking of sacred space. That's the subjective, call it naive, call it interpretivist point of view. Move out and look at it now from a more objective, cynical angle, religious leaders have power and authority to take secular space and make it sacred. They can do this because they have followers, and they can do this because they have religious know-how. They know the rules, and these rules can be very intricate. It's not easy consecrating a cathedral. It's actually quite complicated, and there are similar procedures in all religions for maintaining and consecrating a sacred space. The community is dependent on a religious leader for advice. If you're the leader of whatever religious community you happen to be in, let's assume that you are, let's say that you're a Buddhist and you go to a Buddhist temple regularly, and let's assume that tomorrow the chief authority over the temple says, "Harry, I've looked into the temple, and we've made a terrible mistake in building it. This temple is not sacred." There's not a lot you as Harry can do to argue. You're just going to have to take his word for it and wait until he fixes whatever needs to be fixed. You're not going to say, you know, "Excuse me, Mr. High Priest, I really think, you know, if we just do this little thing here." You have neither the ability, you don't have the charisma, you don't have the following. You are quite dependent on him as a source of wisdom and authority. First of all, that suggests that when you're negotiating over sacred space, you've got to talk to these people. They know stuff. They know the boundaries. They know the value. They know restrictions on access, restrictions on behavior inside the sacred space. They can give you pure, raw info. But second, and here we're coming back to the Israeli case, they can manipulate sacred space. Not always. Not with ease. If they go too far, you will abandon them. If the head priest of your temple says, "Harry, I've just decided this is now a church, and we are now going to conduct Sunday services," you're going to say, "Mr. High Priest, I can tell you've lost your mind. I'm going somewhere else. You are no longer my priest." So he can stretch the meaning and the boundaries, and he can do this carefully, particularly at times of conflict and war, when there's uncertainty about the meaning of this space. And that's what happened in 1967 in Jerusalem.
And also Saudi Arabia at the Mecca site. And again, we won't, you know, go into all of the details of the solution, but here again was a way, a place where the interface between religion and politics came up with a solution that was both religiously acceptable and politically acceptable.
That's right. So in the Jerusalem case, let's not let the viewers, you know, be too tense. We should give away the ending. In the Jerusalem case, the leading rabbis of Israel issued a religious proclamation that prohibited all Jewish access to the Temple Mount for religious reasons. Although a closer look reveals a combination of a religious, explicit religious and political logic. There were problems of purity. There were risks of desecration. The rabbis also realized that Jewish access would mean violence, and so they said, we hereby issue a proclamation. And this proclamation was a tremendous boon to the Israeli government. In the Saudi case, the problem was, how do you flush insurgents out of Islam's holiest site when the number one rule governing sacred space in Islam is no bloodshed? And here came, again, out of consultation with the Saudi ulama, these are the religious elites in Saudi Arabia, a ruling that suspended this prohibition so that military operations could be performed, insurgents could be flushed out, and then the prohibition was once again put back in place. As you point out correctly, in neither case is this a purely religious ruling. The very assumption that there is such a thing as a purely religious ruling is ridiculous in Judaism and Islam. Judaism and Islam are lived religions. Every religious ruling has political implications. Every political ruling has religious implications. Both the ulama and their colleagues in Israel, the chief rabbis, realized that the religious ruling had to be both politically reasonable and politically useful, and vice versa.
So as we're coming to the end of our hour, let me ask you two questions. What a policy maker watches this interview, or better yet, reads the book, and it strikes me that going down the road of thick religion, understanding it, is at first instance, it seems to be opening a can of worms. The complexity is very great, and so on. So what is the way to navigate this? To recognize that religion is important on some issues, not just on sacred sites. We need to talk to and understand these different religions. What are the steps you have to take? Do you build a sub policy group that does religions?
Yes.
By that I mean studies religions.
Yes, and I'm not the first to say this. Madeleine Albright said so in her most recent autobiography. She has several. She comes out with a new one every couple of years. She said, when I had an economic decision to make in the State Department, I turned to economic experts. When I had a legal decision to make, I turned to legal experts. When I had a religious issue, I had nobody to talk to. Because we insist on the separation of church and state, we are wary of bringing religion into the debate, and you have to do that. So conclusion number one, if at all possible, strike relationships with religious leaders. It's inconceivable to me that on September, I think it was 13, when George Bush assembled various religious leaders in the White House for sort of discussion about religion and violence, he was unable to find representatives of the American Muslim community to invite. The White House simply had no relationship with local Muslim leaders, has no relationship with Muslim leaders around the world. That's inconceivable to me. That should be part and parcel of diplomacy. So that's number one. If you cannot get hold of religious leaders, talk to religious experts, right? So my message to Barack Obama is call me. Talk to people who have studied the topic and realize that you cannot just rely on cold political analysis. You need to know something about the religions you're facing with. And conclusion number three is arm yourself with pessimism. The primary conclusion from my study of conflicts over holy places is they cannot be resolved. they can be managed. They can be managed better. Most often they're managed worse by leaders who attempt to divide what cannot be divided or bribe what cannot be bribed. These conflicts are endemic. The more significant the sacred place, the more likely they are. So the possibility of concord exists only in sacred sites of no significance. But that doesn't mean that you cannot stem the violence and prevent bloodshed through smart management and consultation.
And then finally, what would be your advice to students who find this topic compelling, either because they're religious or they're not religious but want to be involved with the solution of these kinds of problems? How do you prepare?
Well, primary advice would be come to Berkeley and become involved with the Religion, Politics, and Globalization program, which we take great pride here at Berkeley.
Which is in the Institute of International
Studies. Which is in the Institute of International Studies and sponsors talks and conferences. Most recently, we had a fascinating conference on religion in the military. It's important to study politics, and political science has a great deal to teach us about disputes, dispute resolution, causes of war, the trajectories of territorial disputes. Once you're done with that part of the work, you now need to take on the second half of the work, which is study religion. Look, Harry, it's obvious to us, if I were sitting here talking about politics and economics, or politics and geography, or politics and psychology, you'd say, well, my advice to my students would obviously be, study some economics or geography and psychology. The same goes for the study of politics and religion. You must arm yourself with either theology or sociology of religion or comparative religion. It's a separate field with vast differences in methodology, and those differences need to be braved.
Mm-hmm. Well, on that note, Ron, I think you've done a very good job of convincing people not only of the importance of the subject, but also of the need to really understand it, actually. So let me show your book to our audience. And since you didn't tell us the whole story of the solutions, people will have to go out and buy it. So thank you very much.
Thank you for having me here.
And thank you very much for joining us for this conversation with history.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.